I thought about the infinite greatness of the Father, the creator of all these wonders, and prayed that he might teach me to love him in my brothers, and in all things that were created by him. In the certainty that he had heard me, I said to him that it was my most ardent wish to learn enough about universal laws and infinite love to travel anywhere in the cosmos, to go beyond heaven's gate, and marvel at the infinite beauty of unbounded creation. I hesitated, because I was afraid my prayer was too presumptuous for so insignificant a creature. Raphael smiled and his look was full of loving kindness. "No," he said, "the righteous wish to dwell in the Father house of God is not presumptuous. The most ardent wish of the Father himself is that all his children, who are on the path through the cosmos, will return to him." The cosmic space which I could see consisted not only of a powerful play of pulsating lights, but was flooded with luminescent particles that streaked out of the dark background of space, as if following a track determined by some invisible force field. Raphael pointed out to us the mighty cigar-shaped spaceship that hovered there in space before us, at a distance that was difficult to estimate. It was surrounded by a white glow, which shifted occasionally to a delicate orange or blue chromaticity. Light rays streaming from the round windows of the great cigar-shaped space vessel added to the luminous effect. The ship was longer and more slender than the one that had landed on the ground at Spotorno. It was a dramatic and awe-inspiring sight. Raphael announced that we were about to enter the ray ship with the flying disc. A moment later, we stepped out into an inner landing room where the disc had set down. I saw a light coming from one wall. Through a door, we were led into a reception room. There stood a table, some easy chairs, and a sofa. They all seemed to be made of the same material, which was slightly translucent. Upon being seated, I noted that the chairs were quite firm, yet pleasantly yielding. The light within this wonderful ray ship produced an effect on us which I was unable to explain. We felt freshened and renewed, and all our spiritual energies rejoiced in an indescribable sense of peace. At the same time, we found ourselves in a state of well-being which changed us and awakened all the sleeping powers within us. We felt keenly receptive to all that might be imparted to us by words and images. Our hearts burned with an all-inclusive love, such as is rarely felt on earth. Ilmuth came in, and with her a man, whose appearance evoked admiration immediately, by reason of his beauty and congeniality. We sat in a half circle on the sofa and chairs. The man looked very kindly at us and started to speak. "Our mission to you, which was initiated from above, is coming to an end. But here you have the opportunity to learn and experience things that will help you to be prepared. We must speak to you about a great many more things than we were able to before this, in view of the short time at our disposal, and other problems that we had to undertake to mitigate on your behalf. That should not trouble you, for we will stand by you always, and give you the light and help that will be absolutely essential to you." At this point Orthon came in, and with him, Zal. They sat down and remained silent, while the man continued his discourse. "On Earth," he said earnestly, "there are many serious and pressing problems. The underdeveloped state of many parts of the world results in starvation and death through undernourishment and disease, as a consequence of poverty. That is a very heavy burden of guilt to be borne by those people who have a thriving culture. On Earth there are so many resources and means of alleviation, that everyone could be provided for, as needed, in an orderly fashion. But egotism and inordinate desire for wealth and power are the reason that the poor suffer terribly and are lost." Tino interrupted him and asked, "Why don't you intervene to save these people from starvation? Why isn't it possible to arrange things so that those who have the potential and the will to ameliorate these deplorable conditions might be enabled, with your help, to do so?" The man wrinkled his noble brow and sighed. "That we cannot do," he said emphatically, "and that grieves us sorely. If we were to inject ourselves so openly into the affairs of your planet, we would create much more serious and difficult problems. We have already told you that you are acquainted with only a part of the problem. Actually, we have had to take action in order to bring about a more just distribution of blessings, and we have also had to intervene to a degree, in your warlike confrontations. Everything would be different. We would be drawn into the tangled web of hatred and power-seeking that prevails on Earth, and we, too, would be acting out of a position of superior power and might. In contrast to that, the universal laws are in a position of being able to ultimately root out, once and for all, by way of divine patience, the evil that is within man. Those who suffer unjustly will be rewarded in measure far beyond your ability to comprehend. Therefore, the one who came to earth and gave his life for his brothers said, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs is God's kingdom. Blessed are those who now hunger, for they shall be filled. Blessed are you who now weep, for you shall rejoice." And he also said, "Rejoice on that day and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven." There are so many, and such good reasons, why we work on the spiritual root cause of your condition. We work in the innermost hearts of those who suffer, and are the angels of comfort to those who bear heavy burdens. The Father has given us this assignment for the earth, for this planet which we watch over and love, and which, in spite of all appearances, we are leading to the great healing, in order that all may find the one who longs to bring them to the heavenly dwelling that is their birthright. Did he not say to you before he died, "You are from below, I am from above, you are of this world, I am not of this world"? Before he parted, he said, "If I go, and prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you with me, so that where I am, there you may be also." He, whose wisdom was far greater than ours, and whose love more than contained all that we are capable of, could foresee all things, and understand all things. He taught us that patience is one of the great paths to everlasting life. The evil which has taken possession of so many rebellious brothers is so tough, it will only meet resistance with counter-resistance. The patience and suffering of good people stand in contrast to this. They will gain the victory over error. To meet violence with violence, force with force, and evil with evil, would not root out the latter, but would only create favorable conditions for the triumph of evil itself, as has happened time and again over the past thousands of years on Earth. Our understanding allows us to avoid such errors. Thus the scriptures refer to the patience of the righteous and of the saints. He was silent, and it seemed as though he was well aware of how much trouble and sorrow there was on earth. His countenance brightened to a smile that indicated hope, and he went on, "We have said to you that this is really the end of evil on earth. Already the seventh trumpet stands ready to announce the tidings of release. The seventh seal is already broken, through the action of the one who never lies. The cup of godly anger is filled for those who, for a long time, have taken perverted delight in the suffering of others." These last words were spoken in a strong voice, and I was troubled and astonished to hear them. Paul, who always had so little to say, looked at him and asked, "How is it possible to reconcile the love of the Father and the universal brotherhood with the godly anger that you have just spoken of?" The man sighed. "When a father has good children and obstinate children," he said in a low voice, "he first gives a warning to the unruly ones. When, however, they continue to ignore the fatherly advice, and stubbornly act so as to endanger both themselves and their brothers, then the father's warning becomes stronger. But the father's severity is not ill-intentioned. He is a good father, and his only concern is for his sons to use good judgment, for their own sakes. If, however, the sons persist in insane acts which threaten their own existence, the father will have no recourse but to use all his might to avoid such a disaster. And when an incorrigible son turns against him in contempt, and inflicts unending sorrows on his brothers as a result of a self-seeking desire to dominate others by might, and to impose his own will at all costs, then will the father, spurned and betrayed, find that his heart burns with anger. A strong punishment will then be the last possible means to prevent the total corruption of the recalcitrant one, who otherwise would subvert the good and peaceable sons. The people of earth should come to realize that the godly anger, which the scriptures often refer to, is not just a poetic figure of speech, but the greatest sign of the Father God's love for his wayward children. We worship God for his loving kindness, his mercy, and his justice, which are infinite. But we also worship him for his godly anger over the children of earth, who have brought about the conditions for the destruction of their own consciousness, and the material life of the planet. He drew his hand across his forehead, then drank a small amount from a cup. At this point, Raphael took over the discourse, and said, in his pleasing and earnest manner, "Yes, the people of Earth are arming themselves for the destruction of the planet. They have amassed an enormous quantity of deadly weapons, and seek to justify this by maintaining that if they did not do it, the others would. That is as if we were to arm ourselves to the teeth in order to destroy the people of Earth, and God the Father were to say, if we were not to do it, then the people of Earth would. That is an insane philosophy, which has been used on Earth through the ages to justify evil in all its forms. However, that will in no way absolve man of the crime of preparing for the destruction of one of the most beautiful dwelling places in the Universal Father's Kingdom." Raphael was evidently very much concerned, and his manifest anguish reflected the depth of his love for our Earth and its inhabitants. After a short pause, he continued, "We repeat what has already been written, that God will arm his creation. Then all will come to know how right the scriptures are, for the words which the Father has revealed to us, and which we, since the earliest days, have transmitted to you, are true. All things which the great masters, and foremost Christ, the universal sovereign Lord, have said, will be fulfilled, as has been the case up to this very moment." He held up his finger, and I noted with what rapt attention all the brothers who were present listened to his words. He told you that you would hear of rumors of wars and great devastation. He said that this would not yet be the end, but that, shortly before the end, such things would occur. Do you not have the impression that the earth is already to ignite itself, like a field with many small fires before the mighty conflagration? Is it that you do not allow yourselves to grasp the daily possibility of self-destruction of the planet as the impending fulfillment of prophecy? Jesus said to you, that you could indeed discern the signs of the weather, but not the signs of the times, and therefore you were hypocrites. Do you not, then, find it impossible to deny these obvious truths? Now Firkin joined in, and he begged us to think over carefully what John had delivered to us concerning the words of the Lord Jesus Christ. "You can read the words of the Master," he began, "in the Gospel of John. There are many things I have yet to tell you, but you could not understand them yet. But when the Spirit of Truth has come, he will guide you into what is yet to be, for he shall not speak of himself, but what he has heard, that will he speak of. Today it is given to the people of Earth to understand many things that were predicted. They want to hear them. That will make it possible for you to look forward to the great disasters which threaten the planet, and not to fear the powers of evil, which will be unleashed in the days ahead. The more the powers of evil oppress the children of the Father, the more the Father will answer the needs of his own with help, light and strength, in order that they may come through victoriously, according to the laws of love." Calnu invited us to stand. The serious words of prophecy that we had been hearing did not deny us a sense of deep peace and even joy, to be here on this wonderful starship. We were aware that the ship was not standing still in space, but was moving at a rate that would have seemed an impossible speed to Earth people. This knowledge only served to increase our sense of well-being. How well the brothers treated us! Our hearts were at peace, and our minds were being constantly opened up to new truths and ways of understanding. After those last words about the promised assistance to the people of Earth at the time of the great happenings which the planet would soon face, we were led into another room, where several of the brothers were gathered. We all sat on comfortable cushions, on a little raised platform made of wood. Kalner and Firkin remained with us. Raphael and the others said they would rejoin us a little later. I examined the cushions with great curiosity, and together, Tina, Paul and I discussed the color and the material of the covering, which appeared to have no seams or fasteners. Kalnus said, "Soon the Earth people will enter upon very sad times, the consequence of their errors of many centuries. But God, in his great love, which constantly unites him with his children, has prepared his plan of salvation. The scriptures have taught you all that you need to know in order that these days will not come without warning, nor find you unprepared, but rather that you may abide in the true light and receive divine solace. That which Jesus could not make clear to the people of his times, because they were not prepared, and were as yet incapable of understanding it, the times being not yet ripe, will become known to you in the coming years, and you will learn of it in fullest measure. This knowledge will be indispensable to you in helping you to confront these experiences. Just then, Raphael and Orthon came in, and at the same time, four other men and three women. After greetings were exchanged, they sat down near us. Raphael requested our attention, while several presentations were shown to us. Kalna began to speak, "Now you will see some scenes," she said, "concerning that event which you call death, and we call transition. Again, as before, we saw a little colored cloud grow larger and form itself into figures. The scene showed a sick man lying in bed, evidently close to dying. He breathed with labored gasps, and there were some people, whom I took to be family members, standing near the head of the bed." "This is a scene on Earth," said Kalna. "It is going on right at this moment somewhere on your planet. We can, if we choose, show you scenes from the past, from the present, and sometimes even from the future. Watch, and see what happens now." I watched with great curiosity, and suddenly it seemed to me that the one man became two. A figure exactly like the man, but very light, rose up horizontally from the bed, and after turning in the air, slowly lowered itself until its feet were touching the floor. At the same time, the man in the bed stopped his heavy breathing and lay very still, while the members of the family began to weep and wail. The body of the man on the bed lay lifeless, motionless, eyes closed, while the duplicate figure looked at the body on the bed and the crying relatives with an expression of surprise. He tried to comfort the people, and make them realize that he was not really and finally dead, but they paid no attention to him and continued their lamentations by the body on the bed. Kalna now explained the scene to us as follows: "This man, this earth brother, has now come to the end of his earthly existence. Now he is living in a new body, in a new, higher frequency of life vibration. He is astonished to see his coarse material body lying lifeless on the bed, and it took him several minutes to realize the true state of affairs. He wanted to be in union with his relatives, who were bemoaning his physical death, but did not yet realize that he was now living in another dimension, different from the material one. This brother is now learning two new realities through direct experience. First, he has made the wonderful discovery that there is life after death, without the physical suffering that had so plagued him at the end. Second, that he cannot make himself understood to his loved ones, who are still in the material life. He realizes that, although he can still see and hear them, it is no longer possible for them to ascertain his living presence directly." Kalna interrupted her talk long enough for us to see how useless were his efforts to get those people to realize that he was still alive, and that bodily death did not extinguish life. "Now you will see another scene," Kalna announced. "The first meeting with the brothers of other dimensions, brought the from other worlds, to receive this brother who has just made the transition from the dimension of gross materiality to a different form of life. We have already told you that, throughout creation, no one is left all alone in his time of need. We saw men and women arrive at that place, as though they had come through the walls. Their ages seemed to be between 15 and 40 years old. The youngest, who still seemed like a boy, walked up to the man, who at this point looked to be perhaps 40, although his body on the bed looked significantly older, and embraced him. He called him Papa, and the man threw his arms around his neck with the words, 'My child. How happy I am to see you again. I have missed you so very much. But how is it that you are here?' The boy didn't answer directly, but said that things were going well with him, and that he had been waiting for him for a long time. There were embraces and moving words exchanged between the man and all who had come to receive him. The man looked again at his lifeless body in the bed, and wanted to speak with the mourning relatives, but the others explained to him that this was not possible, and they added that they would later show him how one could keep in touch with those who remained on Earth, through thoughts and love. I was surprised, and I could hear Tina say repeatedly, "That is unbelievable, but wonderful." Paul spoke briefly about how greatly this demonstration of the truth of ongoing life had impressed him. "Especially when you consider," he added, "the horror with which most men view death, and the years that they spend mourning the death of loved ones." During the showing, I asked Gallner why such a great truth could not somehow be brought out to the people as common knowledge. "There are reasons," she answered, "why Earth people cannot know all about the true state of affairs. Through sorrowing and seeking, which are necessities born out of their impoverished spiritual condition, they attain an inner worth, and are enabled to raise their consciousness to a level from which they can appreciate these living realities." Meanwhile, the brothers who had come to receive the departed man took him to a new place that was quite different from the room where all this had been taking place up to now. "You see now the astral reality," Kalnu explained, "that is, the living reality corresponding to the energy field of higher vibrations in this place where they are in a finer degree of manifestation. They didn't walk very much, and, in fact, it seems to me that they moved forward while scarcely touching their feet to the ground." The man took a few steps at first, but after observing the others for a moment, he too was able to go forward without moving his legs, just gliding easily over the ground. The group came to a small reconnaissance disc whose door stood open. "We are going inside now," the boy said to his father. "Then we will go to the place where we live." They entered, and the disc rose from the ground and disappeared into the wide expanse above. The scene ended, and light came on in the room again, bathing the beautiful wood-grained surfaces with warm tints of color. Firkin again took up the discourse, "We bring to you the relatives, friends, and acquaintances who are waiting for you on the higher worlds. If some of them already are living on planets beyond the heavenly boundary, they are in a position to will themselves to come here from the higher universe. However, if they find themselves on planets that are not yet very highly developed, then they need our help and our spacecraft in order to travel through space. At the time of physical death, a person is brought to another world. The removal from Earth, without the dense, mortal body, may be accomplished either by means of a flying disc and starship, or by the use of cosmic or mystical supernatural power, depending on how highly developed the consciousness of the individual may be. In the latter case, he may be brought to his destination in the universe by the application of the law of duplication. To do this, the new astral, or spiritual body is enveloped in a protective life force shell, which very quickly brings the brother to the desired place. This means of transport can also be easily used by us, if we wish. Many strange apparitions actually occur in this way, if the visitor from other worlds too often uses this means of making contact with persons of Earth. Normally, however, when more than two persons are transported, the best way is to use the spacecraft. This affords greater safety and assurance of preservation of the life energy in accordance with the cosmic laws. On occasion, Raphael explained, we can lift an Earth dweller from the face of the planet without the flying disc having to land, and without his having to enter through the door of the craft. From the flying disc an energy field is sent out, which lifts him up and inside of the craft by momentarily raising the vibrations of his life force. The energy we send him envelops him, protects him, and frees him from the physical laws of gravity of the planet. Raphael interrupted his talk. The melodious sound of beautiful music filled the room of the starship. Tina began conversing with Kalner, and Paul with Orthon. Firkin told us we would now have a short intermission. He informed me that the starship was not far from the place we were going. I asked him several questions, some pertaining to my private life as an Earth person. He answered them all with such patience and loving kindness that I was moved to ask, why is it that you show us so much love? Firkin held his hands up to heaven and answered, God loves us, and we love you. We continued in conversation until Raphael again requested our attention, saying, "The scriptures tell you that when the time of tribulation comes, all the people of the earth will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. He will, the Bible says literally, send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other." It says further, "It will be as in the days of Noah." In truth, as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until Noah entered the ark, and knew they nothing until the flood came and took them all away. So shall it also be with the coming of the Son of Man. We have, continued Raphael, already reminded you of the words of the Evangel, "Then shall two men be in the field, the one shall be taken and the other left behind. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken, and the other left behind." Now you know what it means, to be taken from the earth, or lifted up, or evacuated. You have seen, and we have explained in what manner this may be accomplished. I recall the scene they had shown, and Kalner's words of explanation, and finally, Raphael's further elucidation. Picture in your mind, Raphael began again, the situation on your planet right after an atomic war, as we showed it to you once in Cosmic Contact. In such a case, we would immediately evacuate the Earth brothers from the surface of the Earth, but we could not do this for the enemies of love, even if we wanted to. The life energy of their bodies, as a result of their state of consciousness and the disordered and impure condition of their finer bodies, would not allow us to evacuate them from the Earth. And even if it were possible for us to do so, it would be a greater evil than for them to be left behind on Earth. For this reason, Jesus spoke to you about the fires of Gehenna, and of a hell, which perpetrators of evil, death, and all wicked thoughts and deeds will experience unless they are purified through deep felt, honest repentance. This works to cleanse and restore balance, and so creates the conditions of life energy for a reconstruction of the life expression at an appropriate level. These brothers would see us as something terrifying or monstrous, for their consciousness is sadly deformed, and, in addition to that, they would suffer harm from the energies of our flying discs and starships, as their mode of life would seem to be so completely turned upside down, it would not be able to accommodate the harmonious and unchangeable order which is the rule with us. The inner torment of one who is so out of harmony with the universal laws of the Father, is in itself a means of salvation and a reminder, in spite of all impenitence, that true freedom is found in goodness and in love for the Creator and the brothers. In any case, even if, through the Creator's forbearance and our intervention, Earth humanity were to escape the tragic moment foretold in the scriptures, the Lord would still come, and we with him, to prepare for the final victory over evil in the world, and the evacuation from the earth for all who can be saved will follow, before the end comes. Raphael having apparently ended his discourse, I ventured to ask a question. "You have told us that the fulfillment of the third prophecy of Fatima pertains to the time just before the beginning of the thousand-year reign of the kingdom on earth. Is it absolutely unavoidable, that there should be a third world war, an atomic war, to destroy the powers of evil and to bring in a new age of lasting peace?" Orthon sighed. He folded his hands and seemed to be searching his innermost thoughts. "The Mother of Jesus," he said, "is, next to the Lord, the wisest and most worthy of the heavenly beings. Her love for the Father, for Jesus, and for us all, is immeasurable. She has greater understanding than any other child of the Father. To us, she is our great sister, but, more than that, she is our great mother, the mother of the omniverse. This wonderful, royal woman of the universe remains in indissoluble union with my soul, and enkindles my heart with pure, unending joy. Tina often speaks of her, and constantly affirms that she loves her more than she can say. We always feel her presence with us." Raphael took up the thread where Orthon had left off. "She appears on Earth far more often than most people are aware. Several times she has certified her presence with signs that arouse awe and wonder, such as at Fatima, where, through the sun marvel, She announced and verified that you stood at the beginning of the apocalyptic times, foretold by John. Two parts of the message revealed at that time have already been fulfilled.